podcast devoted to the 69th best show of the 21st century. I'm one of your hosts, as always, Ryan Swen, along with
Ian, the co-host.
The co-host. That feels a little bit too, I don't know, one-sided or something like that.
No, it's fine. I'm a subsidiary here. I did have a brainstorm over the break. That I thought that the Beatles' Nowhere Man would make a great intro song for our podcast. For licensing reasons, probably ought to avoid anything the Beatles did. But I just wanted to drop that for the listeners here. So just imagine that you've just heard Nowhere Man.
We definitely have a lot of back and forth deciding what songs to use. Like one of the ones that we're sort of footing around was going songs off of the band, like post 9/11 band songs on the, which is a eclectic list. There were a few Beatles songs on there. I think Here Comes the Sun was one of them.
Yeah, that was one of them on there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then there was, maybe it was a McCartney song that was on there too.
Oh, maybe. Live and Let Die, maybe. But welcome back from our brief, I guess, one episode off break from the holiday season. I hope that you all enjoyed it, that you hopefully had a much more fulfilling vacation than Jack Bauer will never have, seemingly for the rest of his life.
I hope you leapt into every Christmas tree that you encountered.
We haven't actually talked about Kiefer's sort of off, I mean, I don't know, like if we'll have like many chances to sufficiently talk about them, but I mean, there's a certain sub, I mean, we've talked about his post 24 stuff, but like not pre or during 24 struggles, I guess you could say.
Yeah, you know, I think his whole like pre 24 career is maybe worth us doing like a whole series on at some point.
Yeah,
because definitely. I just kind of like, for me, and it's because of my age solely, but for me, like he's so associated with 24.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he has this very different career before that like could have gone in a much different direction. Like his career could have been like, you know, and this is not to say they're like commensurate in talent or anything, but like his career could have looked not unlike someone like Joaquin Phoenix, you know, had he chosen to go that direction, like from the place they started from, or are not that different.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, then he ends up on this sort of like TV powerhouse. I think a couple weeks ago over the break, I posted this recent interview with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of talked about 24 being like the first time he ever felt like he had a real job, and like something reliable, which is something I kind of forget about actors. Cause like, obviously there's movie stars who make a ton of money and don't have to worry about, you know, months without employment or anything. But, you know, for someone like him at that stage, who was just like kind of a working actor with, you know, a decent amount of notoriety, but like, yeah, you could, if you go like 6 months without work, like it's probably hard to make ends meet if you're not super self-disciplined, which, you know, from what I know of his biography, he maybe had a little bit of a problem with in his younger days. But yeah, I think partially because I don't know as much about his early career as I'd like to, but also because I think it sort of informs or could inform his on-screen persona here. It's probably worth thinking about more.
Yeah, definitely. Even though I'm a little bit younger than you, it's still because I grew up watching 24. It was definitely a thing where he was identified solely with 24. So even I remember I was watching A Few Good Men with my parents a long time back, but we were sort of noting how he was already like really impressive, just in terms of his shouting and all of that. And of course, there's his iconic performance in Fire Walk With Me.
That's such a great performance too. You know what? Maybe I take it back. I think Kiefer Sutherland might be as talented as Joaquin Phoenix and just hasn't been given the opportunities that Joaquin has.
Yes.
Imagine Kiefer Sutherland in Inherent Vice.
Oh man.
I think that would absolutely rule.
I mean, I want to see the version where he plays both Joaquin Phoenix and Josh Brolin's roles.
Yeah, that's great. See,
he could nail both. Definitely.
He could do both. Joaquin Phoenix couldn't do both.
But it's fitting that we're beginning by talking about Kiefer because we're covering the hours from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on day one of his March. And I feel like, even though obviously he's been doing wonderful work, I feel like he's really got some really choice moments in these two episodes, especially the first one, where like in a way that even though obviously as we spent a lot of time with him over the past 8 episodes, I think that there's something, it's, if not a turning point, it's just the situations, just because they're becoming even more cranked up. So he's getting these really, really interesting moments, even if they don't necessarily pan out as well as they possibly could.
Yeah, there's like he gets some like good shouty moments.
In the first scene, like where he's handcuffed to a pole and just screaming at this CTU official.
It was so good. And then also just like you have that with the fact that like here's a man who's been up for, you know, 24 hours already and is just really like strung out on that kind of sleeplessness, but also mm-hmm. the like constant adrenaline spikes of the situation is causing. And so he gets like, we get that point where he like takes a nap accidentally. Like, you know, he gets to do these kind of interesting, like polar opposite kind of moments, because he's just mm-hmm. like a sort of like scared junkyard dog, just kind of like flailing around trying to figure out what's going on.
Right. I do like, first off, that they specifically mentioned that not only that he's been up for more than 24 hours, which I think that you had sort of surmised that he was a wake up at 5 a.m. sort of guy.
He's too intense not to be, right?
Sure. But also that seemingly most of the other employees have been up since. I don't quite see it, personally. I don't quite see most of the CTU people being up for over 24 hours. I feel like, I mean, I don't know how the shifts work, but still.
Well, there's a couple things here. I actually have a note toward this.
Oh, boy.
First of all, is that, okay, so let's just imagine that CTU is like a normal workplace office kind of thing, and everybody works a 9-to-5, okay? Mm-hmm. So let's say that that's the case, and because like Jack gets called into the office.
Right.
Okay. But, you know, presumably, like, yeah, like you're saying, there's like normal places would have shifts and things like that. You'd think CTU would need to be staffed 24/7, right? Yeah. But, you know, let's sort of pretend that it's a 9-to-5. Then, yeah, I could see it. You have people coming in at 9. They all go home at the end of the day, pack up their briefcases, et cetera. And then mm-hmm. there's a terrorist threat and they all have to come back in and then they're up all night. But this episode, these two episodes really highlight the questionable labor practices at CTU. First of all, none of these people are going to be getting overtime pay. Like, we know that, yeah. Okay? Yeah. There seems to be just a totally incomprehensible chain of command going on. There's all of these people that are doing work on something, but I don't really know what, because all of the principal action involved in the Palmer thing is like tossed between like 3 or 4 people. Yeah. So I don't know what all these other people in the background are doing. Mm-hmm. Why do they have to be there? Why aren't there, you know, other people being, they have a contractor that comes in to do lower waged work that's better than their tech person. Presumably they have a whole army of contractors they could send in to back these people up, you know, but are not doing that. You know, of course, the whole kind of, which we'll get into, I'm sure, but the whole sequence with Jamie really highlights the way that, you know, employees in this workplace could really use a union.
Yes, exactly.
And they don't have one.
Yeah. It's so weird. I mean, it's, first of all, poor Jamie. It's just extraordinarily unserved. I mean, she gets some good moments.
Yeah, this is a rough stretch.
Yeah, it's a rough stretch for her. Since this is the last time I think that we'll see her alive, Karina Ariave, she does some really good work in this sort of last episode that she has, in terms of that sort of back and forth, that sort of wearing down of resistance that she has, especially in that phone call that she has with Jack, which is, I think, handled really well. But also, it's just sort of very unceremonious the way she goes. I mean, which is for obvious effect, but still.
Yeah. You know, on the acting level, yeah. I think one of the things that happens is the show finally devotes some time to, like, letting Jamie kind of, like, speak to her motives.
Right.
Like, there's something a little sad and pathetic about $300,000 being enough to buy her off, which again goes back to like CTU is clearly not paying their people enough if they can be bribed with $300,000, you know. Like Tony's like 1 million, 2 million, and it's like, damn, he must be getting paid better than she is. She even makes a little comment about, like, you know, doing twice the work of everybody else and getting paid half as much or something like that.
Yeah, which is like this sort of like thing that's just left hanging.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there's the very real possibility of gender wage discrimination, but
for sure.
Also, like, I don't know quite where it's coming from, especially I feel like she definitely hasn't mentioned her son before, right? Before this episode.
If it's happened, it was so minor that it didn't warrant any kind of notice from either of us. And then they're going to bring him in to, like, blackmail, like, emotionally blackmail her.
Yeah,
it's pretty awful stuff, you know?
I mean, that's the first sort of real, like, 24 coercion sort of thing that we've seen. It doesn't actually come to fruition, but still, like, there's this very threat, this ominous sort of thing, and, like, you even get the pushback from Nina a little bit in terms of that, which I think is interesting. Like, you have that moment, and you also have that sort of negotiation, that brief negotiation that Nina has with Milo in terms of his pay.
Yeah,
in terms of his contract pay. I mean, I also just find it very funny that he just becomes roped into this Jack, Nina, Tony sort of thing that's going on. Like, he's just there.
He just seems, you know, he does seem a little bit like a guy who kind of, like, wants to be included. And I think they're taking advantage of that to some degree. I was also thinking, that, Milo and Jamie are sort of like tech people. And I think that this is still a point where that's sort of treated as like grunt work, as opposed to like the integral work of what, some kind of like counterintelligence or counterterrorism does.
Right.
Like, I think it's still like a transition phase technologically, where you certainly have a kind of old guard that you could maybe say is exemplified in someone like Jack, of like, you know, the field work, the gun play, you know, interrogation, that kind of stuff is like where the real stuff gets done. And then you have the tech work as being kind of like maybe looked down upon as like, you know, the province of weightless nerds. But of course, like, Jack would be totally at sea without it, right? But I think to some degree it probably reflects a not totally unbelievable undervaluing of that kind of work. Whereas now, of course, you know, in the wake of the last, you know, two decades and all we know about the way surveillance works and things like that, like, obviously this kind of work is absolutely key and integral to the kind of invasive and like overawing practices of agencies, which, like, CTU is sort of like the fictional corollary of.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I wonder how much it changes, how much we'll see it change in these next two seasons before Chloe comes in, becomes such an integral part in I think it's season three. I wonder, like, how significant we'll see that. But it's definitely, I mean, the technological part is definitely still there. The second episode is sort of all structured around trying to get the trace on Terry's call.
Yes.
And it's sort of, I mean, on some level, it's pretty satisfying watching the sort of progression it goes through, and the sort of, it manages to get a good amount of tension, though of course, like, the whole Terry stuff is something we'll have to get into, and it's definitely not the most well handled of storylines among this. But I mean, it's sort of interesting just the way that these two episodes operate, because even though obviously Jack has been running around for 8 hours at this point, it's sort of a lot more, it feels like it's ratcheted up a lot more, just because he's being constantly pursued by the police and the sort of dragnet that's being drawn around him. And so on the one hand, you have this very sort of tense storyline that still has these moments, like the entire stuff with Lauren, but then on the other hand, you have this fairly, I feel like, especially the Jamie stuff, as good as it can be, sort of breaks up the rhythm, where it cuts back and then Tony's just talking to Jamie, sort of just prodding at her, and also the Kim and Terry stuff, which sort of feels like, for obvious reasons, because they're locked in a room, sort of stuck as well.
And the Palmer stuff too a little bit, which feels like it's already kind of repeating the things that it's done
up to
this point. It's like now that the assassination plot as we knew it has sort of failed at this stage, you know, it's like the Palmers don't have as much, like, the palace intrigue type stuff going on there is still, I think, not not particularly well done. I mean, it's sort of exemplified by the fact that, like, okay, maybe what, like, for me, the way I could envision that being successful is like, okay, what's really going on here is like a certain kind of family dynamic that, because they're always on the move and separated, is not is something that they can sort of like deny, but now it's coming to the fore. But then, like, there's a whole episode where it's like, where did the son go? He's just gone, and then he comes back, and it's like, well, you know, this seems like it would be a moment for this kind of domestic drama to take center stage, but then they kind of like revert to this, like, you know, clandestine phone calls and reversals and all of that. Right. I will say, on the phone stuff, very quickly, two things about the episode 10 is that, one, it exemplifies the show's really elastic relationship with the way this technology works at this stage, because as both the 24 fan wiki and the IMDb trivia page note, this phone call trace takes 30 minutes, and in every succeeding episode, it takes mere seconds to, to trace phone calls. And then also, this features the longest continuous phone call in the entire series.
Yeah.
Which I think is actually a really, like, brilliant structural device in the episode. Despite, again, I think the very troublesome way that that's, like, contrived within the plot.
Sure.
The call itself is an interesting way to keep these characters talking to each other and, like, connecting these disparate areas. But yeah, again, I think it's like the show, I think the show will eventually reckon itself to technology a little bit more as the technology advances. But right now, it still does feel like it's magic when they want it to be, and it's it's like a plot contrivance when they need it to be.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I agree about the phone call. Like, it's sort of handled well, and like there's sort of tension. But also, I think that it can also run into the sort of soap opera problem where you have Jack just like talking at length when... cops are just right next to him.
And like sometimes he's like doing a harsh whisper, and then other times he's talking at just totally audible volume, you know.
Yeah, and you also have Terry and Kim turning away from the window to listen into the phone when they should be looking out to make sure that no one's
also
coming.
Like, again, just talking at normal volume. Like, they're out in the country. It does not seem that Ira's compound is a particularly loud place. Like, I would think that any conversation you'd have where there's like guards walking around would need to be at a very low whisper. There's definitely some like flexibility there because of, you know, TV. You don't want a whole episode of people whispering, I guess, but
it's handled well, and like I sort of like that you have Tony and Nina listening in sort of at the same time. Like, there's an interesting sort of, there are a few good like almost subliminal sort of cuts, or like the first one where when Jack is handcuffed and then it cuts to Jamie handcuffed. Like, that's just like, it's such a good sort of, like, I compared it to Eisenstein. That's sort of like
that's that Hopkins magic.
Yeah, and that's literally the title card that Hopkins' name comes up on. The first one was done by Hopkins, the second one's done by Davis Guggenheim. You might know better. I guess he's done some episodes of Deadwood.
He did a lot of TV, but more notably
The
director of, which I did not know that the same person directed these, and I don't really know why, but the director of there's three things here. Okay, we'll do chronological order. So first of all, the director of An Inconvenient Truth. Okay. The director of the awful charter school propaganda movie Waiting for Superman.
A classic.
And most recently, he did the sort of like family intro segments for the 2020 DNC convention. He was the credited director of all the little like Biden short video segments. I don't think he's had a credit after that, or that was the first one that caught my eye when I was scrolling through.
Is that on IMDb?
It's on IMDb. Let me look real quick to see how it's it was called, I think they even called it the Biden convention videos or something ridiculous like that. Oh, also, I think he produced a lot of stuff too.
He just in the past 2 years, he produced Boys State, he produced Bloody Nose Empty Pockets.
Oh,
he produced Time, he produced Summer of Soul. Like, these are all, he produced Procession. Wow. These are all executive producer things. But still, like, those are some, basically 17, like, these are some, like, great, like, really notable films. But that, like,
yeah, his father was a notable documentary filmmaker as well, I believe, from reading the Wikipedia page.
Charles Guggenheim.
Yeah.
The most honored documentary filmmaker. Yeah, I haven't actually heard of these films, but I mean, these are, yeah, they're, well, some of them are shorts, some of them are features, but yeah.
Yeah. So, weird. Okay. So, also, director of, he named me Malala. Also director of, and this is how it's credited on IMDb, Obama 2012 convention film, Barack Obama DNC 2016 film, Inside Bill's Brain, Decoding Bill Gates. And then here are the, Never Just a Job, Biden convention film, 2020. Oh, no. An Unlikely Friendship, Joe Biden and John McCain, Biden convention film, 2020. When You See Something Wrong, Biden convention film, also 2020. The Granddaughters, Biden convention film, 2020. Joe Biden biography, Biden convention film, 2020. An interesting career.
Yes.
It, weirdly, perfectly in line with the kind of politics of 24 that I think we've been trying to articulate.
That's a good point. I mean, it's sort of, I mean, I didn't really feel like a documentarian's touch. I mean, actually, I haven't seen An Inconvenient Truth, so I don't know exactly the stylings of that. But I mean, it felt mostly, you know, TV, like regular TV sort
of. Yeah, and he's done a lot of, yeah. Like you said, he did some Deadwood. He's done plenty of TV as well.
Yeah.
I will say, I wanted to ask you, I have two LA questions.
Oh.
One has to do with the visual of episode 10, the Guggenheim directed one.
Uh-huh.
LA looks hideous in this episode. That like yellow haze shot, which I'm guessing from reading the trivia and is some kind of stock footage.
Yeah.
But then just in general, the city just looks more ugly than I think it has, and not in like a not in like the grimy seedy way that it did in those early episodes, like a melodramatic way, but in just like a this is a hideous place to be and live. So I was sort of wanting your take on that.
Okay.
And then also I just need you to translate the phrase north of the 10 east of the 405 for like reference for me as a flyover person of like
sure
what kind of area we're talking about.
Well, I mean they say it's basically the north San Fernando Valley.
Okay.
So, sort of close to Inland Empire, so like it's definitely I usually actually the 10 is the freeway I take the most often. Mm-hmm. Just because it's the one that runs to Santa Monica, like it runs east to west. And 405 runs north to south.
Okay.
But yeah, so like it's just like sort of a more remote sort of area. Yeah, the 10 runs a little bit like sort of across, well, not the center of LA, but like sort of like, you know, the sort of area like north to south, you know, the LA metropolitan area. It sort of runs in the center of that. Yeah, I mean, like it's sort of just like, you know, just like more north area, definitely more remote, like Mulholland, I think is, you know, Hollywood, so it's sort of like north of that basically.
Okay.
Like because that's where she gets kidnapped. And yeah, in terms of like the look of LA, like I don't know if this was necessarily intentional, but honestly like it sort of reminds me of the filter they put on Mexico scenes in every movie and TV show, like that sort of grimy sort of yellow orange thing. And they do go to Mexico, I think, in later seasons.
Well, it begins in where? Kuala Lumpur, right?
Yeah, no,
which I think is also subject to that kind of yellow grading. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, the sort of classic thing about LA where people say that it looks beautiful at night at a distance, that sort of thing. and the helicopter shots, or like the shots of a helicopter, like weirdly there's the reporter in a helicopter that gets brought up twice.
Yeah.
Which is, I wish the show would do more of that, you know, that sort of feeling of the LA thing. And because especially on the radio, those, the reporters are very common. Like you can definitely hear them a lot.
Yeah.
And I do like how the wiki notes that this is one of the few times in 24 that Los Angeles' infamously bad traffic is both acknowledged and used as a plot point. I mean, I would say that the traffic is actually somewhat better than normal, because you actually have a good amount of room to maneuver. Jack has a good amount of room to maneuver in this on the freeways here. I don't know which one he's on specifically.
Yeah.
But like that's sort of like you get some more space than like the scene where Lauren has to turn left, like right after she gets carjacked by Jack, is she actually is able to turn left.
Yes.
In like 3 seconds.
Yeah.
And it would take a lot longer at 9 a.m. to do that.
Yeah, I have to note very quickly, Lauren, another Gilmore Girls 24 connection. The actress plays Liz, Luke's sister in Gilmore Girls.
I've never seen Gilmore Girls.
Was instantly recognizable to me, and is another note I'm keeping in my back pocket for when this becomes a Gilmore Girls podcast.
Right, that's one of those sort of shows that I just know the name and I've seen it a bunch, but I have no idea what it's like or what it's about. So I mean, I'm not totally opposed to that notion, but still, it's sort of the thing where like I just don't know what it'd be like.
Yeah, I think this speaks to the gendered experience of the early 2000s, in that you and I, for instance, were watching 24 at the same time that my wife was watching Gilmore Girls. She also watched 24 when it was on TV. But sure. I, of course, being, you know, a moron and fool, did not watch Gilmore Girls until I was married, and have now seen it like a couple of times. It's great. It's delightful. But beside the point. Anyways,
yeah, sure.
It was a fun, I like sort of seeing those kind of faces that I recognize, you know. Uh-huh. On the subject of LA, though, you know, I have just, in quick succession, watched two very LA-centric films. I saw Licorice Pizza.
Uh-huh.
And then I watched Peter Bogdanovich, R.I.P. Watched Targets. Mm-hmm. And that presents a very different version of Los Angeles. Although one, I think, not totally bereft of like beauty, but mm-hmm. definitely more in line with the kind of, with more of an eye for those kind of like no man's land spaces of freeways. And like there's like I think the shooter in Targets starts out on like on top of like a water treatment plant or something mm-hmm. like that, and then you know it ends up at a drive-in and all of that. Great movie, 10 out of 10. Yeah. And then Licorice Pizza, of course, is like a little more romantic and I think mm-hmm. You know, specific to like the valley,
right?
More colorful, etc. Has a much softer eye for the beauty of the place. But yeah, I think this is like the most that the place itself has factored into the show so far.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in like tracking that across the seasons, because I don't know how much it ends up mattering that the show takes place in LA. I'm interested to see whether, like, for instance, the traffic thing. I think like the wiki sort of alludes to the fact that, you know, this is sort of like a, like it becomes a plot convenience later that things just don't take for, it doesn't take very long to get around,
right,
because
right.
you don't want everybody constantly stuck in traffic.
Mm-hmm,
but yeah, I'm sort of interested to see how that evolves over the course of the show. And as the show kind of globetrots a little more later on too.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. Well, first off, actually, I haven't seen Targets. I need to get around to it, but like, that's also sort of a San Fernando Valley Reseda sort of, film. So like there's definitely that sort of remoteness, that something that like say Once Upon a Time in Hollywood doesn't have. Mm-hmm. I mean, not to say that the valley is too remote, but still like it's definitely, you know, a different, like somewhat different area of LA. Like it's, you know, LA but not LA, that sort of thing. And sort of I liked that, something that I actually liked thinking back on it, is that Jack begins, like when he's trying to evade the dragon, that he just begins in this sort of vaguely residential looking area. Like that's sort of mix in LA where it's sort of like moves very unexpectedly between the residential area and the streets, like the city streets. It's something that's very much an LA thing. I mean, some cities can have that as well, but it feels especially LA. Yeah, that's also balanced by the sort of hellishness of LA. Yeah. And I also like that in the conversation that Ira, who we also should mention, gets almost nothing to do in these two episodes. So it's sort of like, I mean, it was sort of baffling that apparently he actually did not have another plan. It's just sort of like restart or like try to do the plan again once they find Jack. In terms of like the conversation that he has with Andre Drazen on the phone, where they say how it's such a unique opportunity to have Jack and David Palmer in the same city at the same time. Like, is LA just remote? Is it just like a place that nobody visits except when they have to for a presidential race?
Yeah, this maybe strengthens the idea that David Palmer is a Chicago politician.
Yeah.
For me. Possibly also like East Coast, but I'm thinking more Chicago. Partially because like there's a rally in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And Illinois might be a Super Tuesday state. I'm not sure. And those things often change, so I'm not 100% sure. But yeah, I mean, so I guess if we sort of take that, then yeah, maybe, you know, like if you're a Democratic politician from the Midwest, say, yeah, you don't, once you get past the primary, you really have no reason to go pander to California. So, yeah, but the LA stuff is always interesting to me because I have, you know, I have no frame of reference having never been there. I mean, my knowledge is like from having looked on Google Maps and having seen movies. So yeah, it's interesting when in the show I'm noticing it become like, it feels, at least to me as someone who's never been there, that in these two episodes it becomes more consequential that like this is the place where it is and that matters.
Yeah.
And that wasn't as apparent earlier on in the show. Of course, taking like a lot of the early action takes place in the middle of the night. That gives you a lot of shortcuts for how things work.
But yeah, like it's definitely the sort of, it's the combination of the car culture and the spread out nature. Like it makes it more easy to have like this long trace that you have to have, like where 25 miles is you just can't work it.
Yeah,
like you can't find a base off of a 25-mile radius.
Yeah,
like that sort of thing does feel like it's using LA in a more interesting way.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you'll have to watch Targets, and we'll have to do a bonus episode on it
because
it's definitely 24 core in a much more, I think, dealing with some of the same subjects in a far more critical way than this show does, and maybe a more responsible way than this show does.
Well, I'm definitely,
it's also just great. Just like fantastic Karloff performance. Great direction.
I was gonna ask you about to elaborate further, but I guess we can do a bonus episode and talk about the 24.
I mean, I can go off on Targets now if you want. I'll talk about Targets all day, but I also don't want to totally derail the episode.
Yeah, I think we still have a good amount to cover, I think.
Yeah, even though I threatened to do that on Twitter. Yeah. You know, we're shaking on, you know, here's the thing. We're shaking off the rust a little bit, a couple weeks off, you know.
Yeah.
We put on a couple of pounds over the break, eating good food. You know, we kind of like, our cardio isn't, we're not up to it yet.
Sure.
You mentioned Ira, and I just briefly want to say that the most interesting thing that happens with Ira in these two episodes is that we realize that he's just like a middle manager. Which like sort of adds a kind of pathetic cast to his character, right? Which it's like he goes from, you know, kind of the mastermind behind the thing,
right.
Which like having watched the show already and kind of know how it works, you always have these kind of levels. It's like the first bad guy you meet is never the ultimate bad guy. And oftentimes he's two or three levels down, you know. But it's still sort of jarring, like you said, to see that like Ira, who seems to be fairly intelligent and a fairly good match for Jack in a lot of ways, does not seem to, it never seemed to cross his mind that things might not go his way and that like he has people in charge of him who might hold him accountable for that. So it is kind of wild to watch that scene. He just kind of has to sit there and take it, and you know, have his like have all of his money threatened to be taken away, have his life threatened, and he just kind of has to sit there and deal with it. And
also the scene really where the feed is cut off and you just get like all those readouts where it's just like video feed disconnected on the screen. And also like when he types into the computer like status report to Jamie.
He does feel a little powerless in these two episodes.
Oh, yeah.
In a similar way, though, that, like, Jack does.
Yeah.
The difference being that, at this point, the show doesn't really have any more use for Ira. Like, he's done what he needs to do, and we're just kind of biding time now until the next bad guy comes in and takes over.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's sort of... I mean, that that sort of, on the one hand, gives more focus on Jack and him running, like, it makes the police sort of like a, well, like, effectively the antagonist of these few episodes, but also there's sort of this, like, it also feels like the show can sort of, Andre is introduced, like, the Drazens are introduced at the right time for it to not feel totally slack in that way, but there is this sort of feeling that it's, even though CTU doesn't realize it, that things are in a bit of a lull in terms of exterior threats to Palmer.
Yeah. They're still in high alert because they really definitely don't know anything. And we do, you know, now we can infer that, like, there is a connection between, you know, Jack and Palmer, right?
Yeah.
I love the, this is one of the quotations I took down, which is that the end of episode 9, toward the end anyways, where Palmer's chief of staff is like, tells him the name Jack Bauer, and he's like, do you know him? And he's like, I've heard the name. it's just like a great little moment.
I mean, he says Jack Bauer like 3 or 4 times.
He's yeah.
Like, Jack Bauer.
Like, yeah.
It's fun. I mean,
yeah, it's a good little, like, it's a little bit, the show doesn't always get playful, but it has these moments. Another one is we have, you know, the running gag again of people having no idea what CTU even is. Like, it's apparently not a very public facing agency that the average person would know about. You know, if you say you're like from the FBI, I think most people on the street, or even like CIA.
Or NSA, really.
Or NSA, yeah. And then it's like, I think it's in the conversation with Lauren, the waitress, that he's like telling her about CTU and she like has no idea what it is. It doesn't really buy it. It's like, you're making this up.
First, before we get to Lauren stuff, I did want to note on the subject of Palmer, something that really amused me and something that I didn't really take note of until now, but Dennis Haysbert is 6'4". And when he's sort of being escorted out from the plant, and the Secret Service guys are like, I get the sense that he's trying to stoop a little bit to be protected by them, but he's just so much taller than everyone else. Like.
yeah, he does. He has a great presence because of that. He really embodies the role in a good way.
Yeah, but also on the subject of another passing that we had today with Sidney Poitier, like, not to invoke numerous black actors, but like, I wonder if like what Poitier in like the 60s, like transplanting him to 2000s, like what he could have done with the role, because like there's a certain I could see them in like, the same lineage, like the characters that Poitier played and David Palmer, like I think that there's a certain commonality there that like I didn't really quite grok until Poitier's passing, that like there's something of that in the mix.
Yeah, and I'm not as familiar with like Poitier's work as I'd like to be.
Same.
Frankly, that's true of Bogdanovich as well. Poitier, I think, has a, like, I think the one thing I would say that, you know, there's that sort of like famous Denzel Oscar speech where, you know, he makes the joke about like, you know, I've always been chasing you, and then, you know, I get this finally, and they give you one on the same day. I mean, obviously he's like a trailblazer, but I think there's also, within the context of 24, there is this kind of generational difference that's being played on between Palmer and his son. And I think Palmer has a certain older style of politics that maybe speaks to the world that like Poitier ushered in. I think that I could definitely see Haysbert looking to someone like Poitier to think about this character, right? Particularly not having, you know, the precedent of like a black presidential candidate outside of again Jesse Jackson, who I think is sort of like retconned out of American political history for the sake of the show, but putting that aside, you know, I think there is some precedent there that doesn't seem totally totally outside the box. Of course, like, this is kind of the way things work. It's like we lose these immense important artists, and then the sort of like the kind of like part of the tragedy of that is that you begin to see them, you can only begin to see them more clearly once they're not there. Like, you begin to see more how because your like attention is called to it in a way that it isn't by just like thinking of a person, you know.
I like the scene in the like when he's talking with the little kid where like he gives that sort of assurance that Black president could come in. Unfortunately, that scene reminded me way too much of Bush on 9/11 when Mike comes in
reading the story.
Like that that sort of like being interrupted at elementary school, like press thing, like it just reminded me way too much of that.
Well, I almost wonder if that's a self-conscious choice.
Yeah, exactly.
On the part of the writer's room.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely like it was written well after, like, but like obviously this was very much in the consciousness. So I was wondering if like that was actually intended as a explicit reference.
I think so. I mean, yeah. I think that it's easy to forget how instantly the iconography of 9/11 entered into like every facet of it, particularly that photo of Bush.
Yeah.
I mean, and you can see how, like, you know, in the very early going, when it was very close to 9/11, something like a plane blowing up was just like not something that they were going to put on TV. But now here we are, you know, really only probably a couple months after that episode aired. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, this definitely feels like it's explicitly playing on that on that moment. In an interesting way.
Yeah.
This also does bring up, again, I know we've talked about this a little bit, but, you know, seemingly the way the writers room worked on the show is, like, they really didn't have a lot of stuff planned.
Yeah. Like, I was honestly wondering about whether the Drazens, like, were plans to come in at this point, or if they just had to write their way out, so they just introduced another party.
Well, yeah, and also, for instance, at this point, you know, and again, this is a podcast that does not worry about spoiling the rest of the show for you, so, but, like, they still haven't decided that Nina is the person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, they end up retconning this kind of later when we find out that Nina actually killed Jamie. Despite the fact that in this episode, it's explicitly said that there are no cameras in the room.
Yeah.
Later on, it turns out there actually was a secret hidden camera that Jack is able to access and see Nina.
Yeah. And
Nina
also
doing the thing.
Also, it looks like there's no time for Nina to actually go and
none at all.
Yeah. Because like she's with Tony the whole time while they're while they're waiting. And like, it's just like this sort of strange thing. I will also say really good squibs on Jamie's arm.
Oh, fantastic. Like I made like a note. A plus core.
It's really rough.
Yeah. I was like, yeah, I mean, for TV work, it was pretty, pretty grotesque. I applaud the makeup and effects crew for that.
Yeah. But yeah, like that's just the sort of thing where I still like, obviously like, Sarah Clark isn't playing her as a mole. So it's just like, but just like reinterpreting sort of moments, just shots.
Yeah,
it's an interesting game to play, even if I can't really come up with anything definitive or concrete.
You know, I'm wondering, like, because there are definitely moments where it feels like, for not just Nina but also Tony, where I think it's like the writers are leaving themselves some escape hatches later. Mm-hmm. Because I assume they are sort of like talking these things out and coming up with possibilities still for like, okay, what's actually going on? Who's actually the mole and et cetera. Yeah. And yeah, it definitely feels like there are moments of like meaningful shots of them just kind of like giving sidelong glances and things like that. Well, you know, when we eventually decide who it is, we'll be able to like say, oh, well, we were setting it up in this way or whatever. And of course, when you're watching a show week to week, it wouldn't, these kind of like continuity things don't matter very much.
Yeah,
but I still find it kind of interesting that even at this point in the show, like we're almost halfway through the show and it's like, they still really aren't clear on the end game.
Yeah. But also like going back to that, cut that I mentioned, or like that shot, like it's where it's on Nina and then it shifts focus to Tony. Like it's this sort of like, and it's happening during the sort of emotional Jack monologue to Terry and Kim. Like it's this sort of weird, like nice suggestion of intimacy between Tony and Nina that hasn't really been present otherwise. Like that's sort of like reminding them that, you know, they are in a sort of relationship. Like it was an interesting moment that registered to me, even like amid this more obvious outpouring of emotion.
And that kind of happens too when Jack and Tony kind of have their heart to heart.
Yeah, it's a nice moment
as well, where you sort of get like, they get a moment where like the adrenaline has decreased a little bit, and Jack can kind of like see clearly that, look, if I was in your position, I'd be doing what you were doing. Yeah. Like you didn't do anything wrong. It was like extremely inconvenient, but like given the information you had, of course, you know.
Yeah. But yeah, I think we still have two main things to talk about. Like one of them is Lauren, and this, like, it's an interestingly played scene. I did find it incredibly hilarious when coming back from the commercial break after he carjacks her, he just started trying to mace him.
unsuccessfully.
And it's not even, I really liked that it was just shunted in the bottom of the split screen. Like it wasn't even like a main thing. It was just him avoiding it and like and yelling.
Yeah, and it's like, I think, was it like dangling from her keys or something? Is that why it's kind of coming at like an odd angle? And or
something
maybe
like
she
that.
Was just like, yeah.
I didn't quite see it because it was just like such a weird thing to just come back from.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
even on the main shot. It was just really funny to me. But I mean, it's this sort of like, I don't remember. I assume that there's a ton of sort of Jack civilian interactions that happen over the course where he has this sort of ally. I mean, you even get that sort of with Jesse, the police officer, back in episode 3, like where is this sort of thing where more ordinary people are like are allied or sort of partnered with Jack for a good chunk of an entire episode or something like that.
Well, and this is like a very fraught relationship because, you know, she's obviously like being threatened by Jack, but also Kathleen Wilhoit is the actress's name, and there's this great moment where like Jack is like trying to sort of like you know, because he's like a good guy, he's like I'm gonna take you hostage at gunpoint, but I'm gonna explain to you why this is totally reasonable for me to do. And she's like she says you're not the only one who has problems, Jack. She's like because she's just going about her normal like shitty day. She just had a bad shift at the diner where they serve the it's the home of the $3.99 all day breakfast, like, and there's something about like these bystanders in the show who are very rarely given these kind of moments. I think that Will Hoyt is like a great actress. Obviously, like on Gilmore Girls, she has a much more extensive part, but there is like a similar kind of attitude, right? That she brings, and like the way that she eventually just kind of rolls with the punches of this a little bit and kind of like develops this rapport with him that's a little bit combative, and how she even gets to the point where she's like, I don't think you'll actually shoot me, which she's right, like I Jack would not kill her, but I think he probably would like shoot her in the kneecap or something like that.
I mean, it was funny just how quickly he turned, like it's just a really good sort of, I mean, like it just that sort of pivot feels very much like Jack, where he can put on that act or, you know, or come very close to actually committing the act. I do feel like none of us know exactly what we would do at that position, but like, I feel like it sort of sells her out, like her choosing to go to the cops. I'm like, you know, on the one hand, it's, you know, reasonable and like, it's something that you would, it's likely that you would do, but still, like, I feel like it sort of sells her out in that, like, especially like putting especially that button where she asks to make sure like whether Terry and Cam are actually in danger.
Yeah,
like having that, I feel like was a point too far, like to like it sort of rang a little bit hollow to me, that moment.
Yeah, it feels like it definitely feels in like a point again in the show where it's like, all right, we got to get out of this scenario.
Yeah,
how do we get out of here quick and easy?
Yeah
because it does feel like maybe there would have been a better way to do that. I'm not sure. And then of course, like, he goes and gets the car and it ends up being like, you know, and then this show is sort of like, the show really flip-flops back and forth on its attitude toward cops. Because like, you get the guys that pull him over and it's like these two fat old cops and he just like burns rubber and they're just like stumbling back to their car, you know, it's like donuts are falling out of their pockets. But yeah, I do think that, like, you know, very rarely do we get just, like, normal people in the show, who just like work places and live normal, banal lives in the midst of all this craziness.
Yeah.
And yeah, I do think it does end up like it's a great part, and the actress does a lot with it. And like, I think, but then it's sort of like, yeah, it's a little bit sold out at the end.
Yeah. Speaking of donuts first, I love that there's a shot when Alberta Green comes in where Milo's just chowing down on a cinnamon roll or something like that.
And this brings up, of course, Jack has still not eaten anything.
I think he just washed his face with the water. He didn't eat. He didn't drink anything.
No, he just splashed his face with water. He's got to be thirsty. Like, you know, I'm willing to like suspend the disbelief of like, okay, we don't want to see, you know, we don't want to see every time he has to like take a piss or something, and that's fine. I get it. But also it's like, yeah, like wouldn't he be rifling through this office for like a candy bar or something? Like, he's got to be starving, you know?
Yeah. I think that also that David Palmer pours himself whiskey, but he doesn't actually drink from it on camera.
Yeah, I don't know what the rules are around that as far as network television goes. I think they're maybe a little dodgy around that sometimes. Oh, that's
also true.
But yeah, it's definitely implied that he is drinking. Like, I would even take that with Jack. I would even be like, you know, cut from commercial and be like, how was that donut, Jack? I would take that as like evidence that he's eaten something. But haven't even done that.
A moment during the Lauren stuff that I thought was interesting, but I don't know if it was necessarily intentional, was when she got the, well, first off, is it assuming that Jack doesn't know what bolt cutters are, or that he assumes that Lauren doesn't know what bolt cutters are?
He assumes that she doesn't.
Okay.
Yeah. And I love that bit because he's like such an asshole and so condescending about the whole thing. And she's like, what do you,
yeah. Know? But like, yeah, like, yeah.
There's bolt a sort cutters. Of,
yeah. There's like a sort of,
this is another, I also thought, we could do, this is an episode where a character literally fetches the bolt cutters.
Yes.
We could use the Fiona Apple song as intro music as well.
That's way too recent for us to use.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just compiling a hypothetical playlist of songs we would use in the episode if copyright law were sensible as opposed to extremely baroque and restrictive.
If I had my druthers and like if it wasn't so recent, I would use Blur Street as the intro for every single one of these episodes.
Look, here's the thing. I have promoted Blur Street probably more than Kiefer Sutherland's official Twitter account. Okay? I am out here. I am telling people Blur Street is out in like 2 weeks. 2 weeks from this recording, as a matter of fact. 2 weeks from today, you will be able to listen to the entire Blur Street album, Kiefer Sutherland's new album. He had to cancel his European tour, but you can still listen to the album.
We need to do one of those sort of like where you have like the teens listening to like an album for the first time. We have to do that with Blur Street, like the entire album.
That's yeah.
Yeah.
We will. There will be a track by track review of Blur Street when it comes out. And at this point, if he plays anywhere near me in the foreseeable future, I will go see Kiefer Sutherland play. It's an obligation. It's a professional obligation.
Yes. But in terms of the, like, I thought with the bolt cutters, I thought that, I felt like there was a good chance that she would have tried to hit him with the bolt cutters. Like, I thought that was like I don't know if they were trying to imply that, but I feel like there's that sort of tension there.
Well, I think there's sort of like, he hasn't really thought this out very much because like, what's he going to do? Blast her from the window? Like, just fire like 4 shots, call attention. And there's like a bleeding lady out in the middle of a work site. He's really like, what's so disappointing about the way that this thing turns out is that like a lot of good sort of like hostage movies and stuff, like you have to develop this weird trust. Like there's this very ambiguous situation. And this relationship that's at first like based totally on domination eventually becomes like a kind of like mutual survival thing. Like obviously, you know, Jack is still the person with the gun, but it's also like she ends up wielding some power here.
Yeah.
And in this moment when she goes out and gets the bolt cutters, it's like that kind of like really evolves the relationship in a way, and that kind of opens him up to like talking about what's actually going on and all of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is why it's so disappointing at the end when she just kind of goes out and tells on him. I like a more interesting thing there, you know, and maybe a way they could have made that more ambiguous is if she sort of like told the cops to go like in the wrong direction or something.
Yeah.
So you get that moment where Jack's like, oh no, oh no, oh no. And then she tells him, oh, he's actually like over there. I saw him. And, you know, then it's like he can like get out of there because you get the same result, you know. But yeah, the bolt cutter sequence I think is really, really great.
And I like how Jack is just, he's just stretching and he's grinning after the, like he's only been in the handcuffs for like half an hour. It's not that cramped of a position to have your arms. He's just like he's definitely been in handcuffs for much longer than that.
And also I feel like
mission.
Once you have the handcuffs in front of you,
uh-huh,
the most annoying part is that you still have these things around your wrists.
Yeah,
that's exactly. Not solved by the bolt cutter.
But yeah, also like the his escape is, like from the plant is amazing.
Yeah.
That's flipping the steam like that. That's just wonderful.
That's a great sequence.
And him just like effortlessly like maneuvering his arms to get in front of him.
Yeah, this is a man who's done this before.
Yes. It's just really fun. I mean, like, scenes like that, which is sort of bookended in the end of the 10th episode by this sort of, like, alternately really fun and also completely ludicrous scene when he smashes the fire alarm.
Yes.
He gives himself exactly 30 seconds so that he can get down into the lobby to beat Ted Koffel or Kofel. I like how they can't even decide how to say his name yet. Which is really funny to me.
That's always been a continuity thing I've never really understood. Like, I was watching... This is a stupid example, but whatever. I was watching Empire Strikes Back.
Oh.
And for some reason, they can't decide how to say Han Solo. Like, all of a sudden, and this is because of the Lando character starts saying Han, and then everybody starts saying Han. Which is really funny. Because it's like, you know, some of those things, it's like, name pronunciation when you're reading a script is sort of interesting. And I wonder who's in charge of that.
I always love how on Memory Alpha, like it says that the pronunciation guide, what the pronunciation guide specifies. That's something I always loved about, I mean, great, great wiki also.
Oh yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. And of course, like the Trek people are insane and that's why they can do things like that. And I say this as kind of one of them, but yeah. I mean, I don't think the 24 heads are quite as quite as over the top as that.
But one more thing from the Lauren part is when I love how like when he falls asleep briefly, which also feels very much germane to as for me who can sometimes be borderline narcoleptic, like when he nods off for just a few moments. I love that he's leaning back against a tropical wallpaper. Like it's just as perfect, and like, and that's as he's talking about how he's been in these hellish places and these terrible circumstances, and how this is the most scared he's ever been. I like how it's sort of almost taunting him. Like I said, that it was basically the closest he'll get to vacation for the rest of his life is this sort of tropical wallpaper that he's leaning against.
Yeah, it's a good time to remember that this man is in hell, and this is only the first ring of hell.
Yeah, which is also what retroactively makes the soap opera sort of talk with Terry and Kim that much funnier.
Well, and also like I think something that starts to happen here is that there's a much heavier implication that like Jack has been through a lot of stuff already.
Yeah.
And that's a little more ambiguous when the show starts.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're not 100% sure what this guy has done.
Yeah.
And of course, someday we'll read all of the novels, and I think a lot of that is actually prequel material. So that might enlighten us further. But yeah, I do think, like, I think Kiefer is in like full control of the character now, and like at least his idea of like who this character is and what he's done. I think that's somewhat reflected, and I don't think we talked about this in the last episode we recorded, but I think it just started popping up. At least when I've been watching the show, I can't remember if it's on the. I've been switching between the files and like just like streaming on like the Roku channel or something. Mm-hmm. And at least on the streaming services, it plays this sort of like heavy-handed intro of like, I'm Jack Bauer, also. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. I just couldn't remember. I've watched a little bit of both of them, so I didn't want to say that incorrectly so you didn't know what I was talking about.
Yeah.
But yeah, you get this kind of like... You get this intro that kind of like explains to you what's going on in the show, and then this like, this is the longest day of my life. Yeah, and it's sort of like this, the show is part of the show, like finding its identity is really determining like who this character is. And like, this is the worst day he's had, but he's had a lot of bad days.
Yeah. On the subject of that intro, I something that never fails to amuse me is the one where it's showing the split screen of like when they're saying people are trying to assassinate the president. It just has to silence the pistol pointed at David Palmer in split screen. It's just so goofy, especially because it was from that like the shootout that we noted as being poor.
Yeah.
In episode two, it's just this, yeah. It's just really funny, just that visual of the split screens.
Yeah.
Also, in terms of like that sort of backstory, like that's what sort of makes the conversation that Terry and Kim, before we get to the real heart of the matter with Terry, the conversation that they have, and it's just this sort of vague like a mission that he went on, and that after he came back, he wasn't quite the same. Like it feels weirdly vague. I mean, like maybe the writers are just trying to sort of give themselves room to work with.
Well, like, and I'm wondering,
but it's just weird. Yeah,
there's maybe an implication that that's when he was away with Nina. Possibly,
I don't think so.
Is it not?
Okay, a few years ago.
And like, okay, I'm a little like the timeline before this day is pretty loose, so it's hard to tell. Definitely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I thought at first that, but then I sort of remembered that there is some like. Eventually, the connection between Palmer and Jack goes back to some kind of mission in Serbia or something like that. And I was wondering too if maybe that was like the thing she was referring to.
I assume so, but it's just like it sort of feels like they haven't, like they know the general outlines of what drove them to be separated for some period of time, but at the same time, it just feels just detailed enough that the vagueness sort of feels kind of irritating.
It doesn't feel meaningful.
Yeah, exactly.
In the way that it would to like that character.
Yeah, especially right?
Obviously Terry doesn't know the thing that he did.
Right.
But
right.
It's like the fact that there's no like specific, like even just like telling us a specific like habit of his that changed or something like that. Yeah, right. It just feels very, and this kind of goes to the whole Terry thing, which is. It sucks, man.
Yeah, it's
poorly
bad.
Written. It sucks. Uh-huh. It's handled awfully. It's totally instrumentalist in the plot. I hated it.
Yeah, you just could have had like while Kim was finding out the guy, like where she could have gotten the phone, the struggle, like when Jack gave John Hawks the number. You could have had something like that where like in the struggle the phone got dislodged or something like that. But instead you have like this. Very, I mean, like it doesn't happen on screen, but still, like it's very gratuitous.
It's like, brutal.
Yeah,
I it's been a long time since I watched season one, and I just did not. This was like memory hold because it must have been very traumatic for me when I originally watched it because it's incredibly traumatic. Like the way that it's handled is, I mean, it's handled in a heavy way. It isn't handled in a. It's not bad because it's like tossed off. It's bad because it's so. It feels done like for the shock value, and like everything is kind of brought to bear to make that as like brutal as possible in the context of network television.
Yeah, definitely. And like it, and you have the character like there specifically for this purpose. Like he was in the past episodes where you know, he was clashing with Rick, but like it, and like you had the sort of seeds planted there, but at the same time, like it just feels like he has, like it just doesn't feel right. In this context, like they're like this sort of, you know, there's a grimness to everything involved because 24 is inherently grim, but there's the sort of the predicament is already like evident as is, and the sort of, you know, like just 30 minutes prior they had guns pointed at their head, and that was like obviously like that's something that the show has to navigate, but like to throw in this and to seemingly not really like go through it or like having it other in intimations, like it doesn't feel like it just doesn't feel integrated at all.
Well, it definitely feels like it's there for two purposes. It gets them the phone, and it's also meant to do some kind of big like heavy character moment, but actually it doesn't do that because what Kim is allowed to do, and I don't think Kim is like a particularly complex or well drawn character at this point, but through this ordeal she's been allowed to like be clever in order to survive.
Yeah.
And I think that this is a really lost opportunity for Terry to do some of that same stuff, right? Like, like to, and in some ways to show like a counterpoint to the way that Jack kind of moves through everything, which is, you know, guns a-blazing. Like these women don't have that option. So for Kim, at least she's been able to like, A, sort of like talk to Rick and come to an understanding, like as that they're sort of like two people whose positions are not that different in this situation, right? And then also to like use some cleverness in order to like find ways out, right? And like for then it to be like this big sacrificial moment for Terry, and then like, well, we're not going to tell your dad about this. Like, it's just grotesque. It's awful.
Like, you don't really need to like have Terry prove her love for Kim, all right? Like, that's sort of like, it's already been established. Like, it's very much like already a part of what the series is going for. And like to have this,
And I mean, in a sort of like, you know, in maybe like a, in a psychoanalytic feminist reading of this show, like one of the reasons this is here is because like, she's going to die. And like, then Jack isn't a cheater, right? Like, even though he is, right? So like, part of the thing is like, oh, well, now she's done this thing, and so now they're like even in a way. And like, I'm not even saying that that's like a thing that the writers explicitly stated or that it, but it's like, in the, like, if you take the text as it is, there are, you know, it's not already a thing that has a lot of problems with the way it deals with women, as we've talked about, but like, particularly with this situation, it feels like it's like, in a way, it's positioned as kind of like a deception on her part, right? Like, like as if she bears some kind of guilt for this, right? And then, of course, later on when she dies, you know, then it's like, you know, throughout the rest of the show, if I recall correctly, you know, Jack has a few different girlfriends and things like that and blah, blah, blah. But they're like, you know, the thing is like, Jack can't hold a serious relationship. He's, you know, and that's part of like, the part of that is like, you know, the ghost of James Bond that haunts the show, right? But it's like, yeah, you have this married guy, and we know within the text of this show that he like cheated on his wife, and that, you know, that makes him kind of an asshole, right? And but now we have this instant, like, but it's important that we don't really see Jack doing that, right? Like, it's just talked about and alluded to, but it's like, we see Terry doing this and then immediately saying, I'm not going to tell your father about that. And it's that moment in particular that is just like so stomach churning. And it's also like, there are pieces in place there to not, like, there's no necessity for doing this here. Like, I mean, it's a pretty sex negative show in general. Which like is maybe like that's network TV is kind of like a sex negative space. So like, it's not even necessarily the show's fault that it's this way. But also it's just like, you have Rick, you have these two female characters, they're all kind of trapped. Like, do we need this other henchman? Like, have them accidentally kill him or something, then have to hide the body and like, you know, do like, you could do more interesting things that created a lot of tension and didn't have this very gross, weird moment. Like, it's very poorly handled. You know, I just, it was, it's, I don't know how much more I have to say about it.
Like, yeah, just like, it doesn't work for
Stephen Hopkins cause. Would never allow this kind of thing.
he was coerced as the director. It shows it's truly a writer's medium. But also like this sort of, I mean, that's also sort of tied into the like the baffling decision to end on like the very obvious intimations that she's pregnant in the end of the episode 10.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's sort of like, it's just like so obvious. Like, what, like, it's just like this, like, is treated as this sort of like huge revelation, but like, it's also sort of like they're, you know, saying, oh, it might be this, it might be that, you know, like, it just feels so, it's just like such a weird moment.
Especially it happens, like when, it honestly happens so fast that I like almost forgot about it.
Like,
but now that you're saying that, yeah, it's just like, bad taste.
Yes, bad taste.
I feel like we gotta end on something that isn't so down. not to undercut the criticism of that
moment. Sure.
But we do get Jack saying, you know, I'm the last thing you'll ever see. He's in taken mode, right? Oh, I had sort of a, and maybe you have a little more, maybe you have a little more insight into this because I think you know maybe a little bit more about just like the craft of making a show than I do, and just like filming things than I do. But I was wondering, like, some of the Jack driving scenes in this episode seem like they were using like the rear projection.
Yeah, it looked like reproduction, like, which is weird because I think most hadn't really noticed that before. Maybe because it's like during the daytime, like it's maybe a little bit more obvious. Like a lot of those episode 10 scenes, but especially it looked like rear projection was, which was weird.
Particularly when he was in the Oldsmobile.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought it looked kind of cool, but
No,
it
I
jumped.
love, yeah.
Yeah, it jumped out to me because I feel like there were other lots of other scenes where it hadn't been
Yeah.
used.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
So I just
Right.
wondered if I was like seeing things.
Yeah. I also like how he spends so much time in that parking lot and then just rolls out in that car and nobody notices.
It's like
Like,
this old beat up
yeah. I mean, he
piece of
also
junk.
like basically pulls a Wingrove in that parking lot.
Yes,
It's just so fun.
yeah.
Like the way he just rolls under that truck.
We also get the great moment at the end of that episode with him driving the limo in those stupid sunglasses,
Yeah.
and that's really awesome.
Yeah.
A couple other things. Oh, when the new head of CTU comes in and says, "Most of you have been up 24 hours. Too bad."
God.
I liked that moment.
I'm assuming we'll get a good more amount more of Alberta Green, but like it's just like this, I don't know, like I feel like 24 very often overplays the sort of officious replacement or like, you know, like person trying to reel in Jack. Like George Mason like is at a good point, like where he's fun enough that it doesn't really that it doesn't bring down things too much. But I think that, like, you know, I feel like that's definitely there's a good chance of that happening. But also I did like the moment with Nina where she said something like, you let him screw you, but you don't let him screw you over. It's just like this baffle. Like there's a certain interesting history thing going on between the two of them that's sort of like I can see working like between Nina and Alberta, but it's like it's also not like I feel like it might overplay it, but we'll see.
Yeah, it gets hinted at here, and I honestly don't have any memory of the specifics of it.
Oh yeah, same.
But yeah, she's like a real hard ass,
Yeah.
which is, you know, definitely an archetype for this kind of thing. But it does seem, at least so far, and again, she's not in it for a very long amount of time, so maybe this will change. It does seem so far, yeah, that like she seems a way less dimensional character than
Yeah.
George Mason,
Yeah. Yeah, like
which
the
is.
sort of yeah, like also during that when she's saying that you get all these cuts to random CTU staffers that you never see otherwise.
Yeah, I think having read some of the other trivia, I think usually they're just like crew members on the show too,
Yeah, probably.
that just like, you know, have to fill some of those wide shots when they have all
Yeah.
these desks and stuff like
Yeah.
that.
But like it really does reinforce just how anonymous everyone else is besides like or like how they seem to do no actual substantial work other than like
Yeah, it, I mean, and like presumably, I guess like the most charitable reading I can give of that is like, okay, this is probably just one of a number of terrorist threats or attacks or projects that they're working on. And like, you know, maybe it's the marquee one for today, which is why they have all the like, you know, main character people on it.
Yeah.
But like, you know, presumably there's like a group of like a few, you know, misfits in the back working on some kind of like, you know, Canadian, Ukrainian, like neo-Nazi group or something,
Sure.
in Alberta or whatever. But yeah, like you really don't, and I don't know if this changes in later seasons, but you really have no scope of the place and of the people there.
Yeah,
Like
yeah.
in some ways, again, it is a workplace comedy without jokes, but I actually think it would be better if they sort of like took that to heart a little bit and
Yeah.
had more of a sense of even just like little bit characters that come in and out that like, you know, like the intern bringing people coffee or something like
Yeah.
that. Like it's really just like, nope, there's only five people here who matter,
Yeah.
but we have a cavernous office space in
Yeah.
LA
Yeah.
that is presumably costing a ton of money.
That's why I actually kind of like the assistant that comes in Palmer's, like when like that greets them when they come back from the hotel. Like that's
Yeah.
sort of I don't remember seeing her before, and like she has like a, you know, she's conveying messages and things like
Yeah.
that. Like CTU could use more of that.
Yeah, just like little little moments like that.
As is like the sort of the admonition, like you better resign if you're not on board with that. Like it just feels, I mean, like A, it feels overplayed. B, it just feels, you know, like it just doesn't make sense because just these people are just here.
Yeah. We do see Tony's Cubs mug again. I clocked that about halfway through episode 10, I think.
A few moments in episode 10, like he has that same like wide-eyed sort of confused look that he's sort of reverted to again.
You mentioned that sort of closing sequence when Jack is like calling that guy's office and being like, yeah, and it's like,
it's business, so weird. College friend. It doesn't work. Like it just doesn't feel like Jack would do that. Like that's sort of like calling.
I actually kind of like that part, improvisation. What I don't like is that he gets there and like speeds up to the guy's floor, like knowing what time he's leaving.
Yeah.
And I suppose the one thing you can say is, well, he doesn't know what the guy looks like. Which is a problem, right?
That's so, like, it just, like it's, I don't get what he's trying to do with this. Like, he's just, like, going there just for a lead, but it just, like, feels much more haphazard than normal for Jack. I mean, Jack obviously there's an element of haphazardness in everything he does, but, like, it feels especially so. I mean, like, yeah, I guess, like, if it was more integrated into, like, an actual plan that he had other than just knowing when he was leaving, it could work, but... as is, like, it's just like an odd choice for him.
The whole like elevator sequence, racing down the stairs, hitting the fire alarm. Yeah, like it just doesn't. It just felt kind of awkward. Although, again, you know, arguably worth it for that closing shot of him in the sunglasses driving the limo.
Well, also arguably worth it for like it's like only a few or maybe one continuous shot of him just racing down these stairs.
yeah some good Jack running, and I like the banter on the phone with like the secretary or whatever when he's putting on like this fake like like sort of happy dumbass voice.
I feel like she looked a little bit like Julia Stiles or something like that.
I could see that. It's not Julia Stiles.
No, it's not, but it's just this like rant, just it, like I like how she has a weirdly large amount of speaking parts.
More than the guy that Jack is actually after, which is sort of funny too.
I mean, he's just thrown in there for, like, I like how you get his name and then you get the Drazen sort of talking about him
just randomly.
I mean, like it's sort of like maybe the show's getting to a point where the scenes are showing more than usual, but I guess we'll see.
It's like that kind of churn into the next level of the intrigue where it's like, okay, now we have to introduce all these new important characters.
Right.
Which is not totally unusual for a serialized show, but which I think feels a little more convoluted because of like the real-time format where it's like, okay, you didn't know about these people a half hour ago, but they're actually very important now. You know, it's like that kind of delayed revelation on these things can sometimes be a little haphazard. But
definitely.
Episode 9, thumbs up. Stephen Hopkins delivers again. Episode 10, not so much.
Yeah. One final thing in the props and minutia section of episode 9. In the ITS room, when Jamie is killed by the second mole, as revealed in the season finale, there is, appropriately enough, a Trust No One poster on the door.
That's a perfect note to end it on.
Yes, that's our advice to the listener heading into 2022. You said that the March 2020 vibes are back.
Back, baby.
Yeah, they're definitely back. Rudy Gobert's got COVID again.
Eternal return.
Yes. So trust no one, but please tune in to our next episode.
Yeah, see you then.